This is the end of the line on the Talk America Radio Network. Hour number one, we spent with Dr. Nick Begich talking about his fascinating book, Angels Don't Play This Harp. This book, just as fascinating, it is entitled Underground Bases and Tunnels, What is the Government Trying to Hide? The author, Richard Sauter, Ph.D. There are, in fact, many more underground bases than you would ever think, and there's more going on than just planning to keep the president alive in a nuclear war. Working from public documents and corporate records, this book by Richard Sauter digs well below the surface of the government's super-secret underground cover-up. Whitley Strieber, the author of Communion and Breakthrough, of course, had this to say about this remarkable book, quoting now, "This is a disturbing and important book, revealing a massive level of secret underground engineering activity on the part of the federal government. There can be no serious question that gigantic subsurface construction projects are underway in many parts of this country. Why? And above all, why the compulsive, paranoid secrecy on the part of the federal monolith? The public deserves to know why its hard-earned money is being lavished on these strange and highly secret projects," end quote, Whitley Strieber. I'd like to welcome back to the end of the line now Richard Sauter. Hi, Richard. How are you?
I'm fine, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing really well, thanks. When did this whole underground thing really start with this country? Was it World War II or even before that? How far back did you,
trace it? I don't know exactly how far back it goes, but for sure, by the end of the 1940s, major underground facilities were already under construction. At the beginning, it seems the fear of the new atomic weaponry was a big part of the motive for constructing these facilities so that the military could burrow deep underground and, to their mind, be safe in the event of a nuclear conflict, but it's never stopped. And the underground base building kept on to the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. Now we are told the Cold War is over, so the threat of an exchange of nuclear missiles with Russia is gone. And you would think that the lid of secrecy then would come off of these underground installations, which number conservatively in the dozens, and I think there are scores of them. But it hasn't, and there's still a super-secret lid clamped on what's going on underground, and I'm not exactly sure why, but there's certainly the military-industrial complex that does not want the average American citizen or anyone else, for that matter, to know what they're doing underground, one, and two, where these underground facilities are.
You know, you talk about the late 1940s, the Cold War heating up, so to speak. In the 1950s, they were showing everybody at home how to protect yourself with a little underground shelter.
Right.
They were showing school children how to get under the desk and
right.
put your head between your knees. And here they are building these massive underground facilities then by essentially crude standards as to what we have today. When did the technology first come to light in your world that there were underground tunneling devices that had been really almost space age in design and implementation?
Well, all the way back in the 1950s, my research has shown that there were already gigantic tunnel boring machines being built.
How big, Richard?
Oh, well, some of them are... I have documentation for one tunnel boring machine that was built in the 1950s that made a tunnel 56 feet in diameter, and it would just bore its way through the rock and soil underground.
That's huge.
Oh, it's huge. And we're talking about technology that existed 40 years ago. So when I hear stories nowadays of machines that will make tunnels, you know, 60, 70, 80 feet in diameter, I've been told there is a machine that will make a tunnel 100 feet in diameter. Well, I don't see why not. You know, if they were making 56-foot diameter tunnels in the 1950s, why not 100-foot diameter tunnels in the 1990s? I certainly think it's possible.
Yes, indeed. What would the power source be then versus now? I mean,
well,
we have a lot of different types.
I believe the power source was diesel engines and or electrical engines, which would have been powered by either conventional generating plant or by diesel engines, somewhat in the manner that diesel locomotives are really they're electrical machines and diesels. The diesels run electrical motors that power the trains that we see.
Yes.
So diesel in the 50s and electricity. And today, I think that you'd still have diesel engines and electrical engines, electrical motors powering these tunnel boring machines. Now, in my book, I discuss patents that were issued to the United States government in the 1970s.
Issued to the government?
Yes.
Well, that's interesting.
If you look
right
carefully
there
at those patents that I cite, they were issued to agencies of the United States government.
That's most interesting.
Yes, for nuclear-powered tunnel boring machines that melt their way through the rock and soil and create, according to the patents now, which are on file, and I give the patent numbers, and if you want, you can go to any federal document repository in the country and look up those patents for yourself.
Extremely well-documented book,
yes.
Richard. Absolutely.
Yes, but the question is, whether the government actually physically made these machines and is secretly using them. I believe it's possible. However, if they are being used, they are being used in great secrecy and covertly on black projects, because I have not been able to find any documentation on the public record that indicates these things are in use, which doesn't mean that they are not in use.
Right. Well, it's pretty difficult, even on the best day in the world, to find documentation of black budget projects. So having found nothing would raise an eyebrow, I think, right there.
Well, if you know from reading my book that I have found some information.
Yes, I do.
On these black projects. So nothing is hermetically sealed. And when you have something, bureaucratic complex as large as the military-industrial complex has been over the last half century, they generate so much paper that some of it is bound to fall through the cracks. They can't absolutely 100% control the paper flow, and that's where researchers like me, who are persistent at digging away at any and all information sources they can find, get lucky every once in a while, and we put pieces of the puzzle together.
I think you're right. I think one of their great luxuries is the fact that very few people are able to put the nose to the grindstone like you do, and like other researchers like Stanton Friedman do. They go after it and they just don't stop, and that's the key, because you're right. So much paperwork, so much data, it can't all be sucked up and put through a paper shredder. It just isn't. We've got Richard, who was called in on Shreveport, I believe, down there. Are you there, Richard?
Yes, hi.
Yeah,
how
go
are
ahead.
You?
Fine, thanks.
What I was calling in reference to is your earlier mention of digging mm-hmm. and machinery, and I was going to ask your guest perhaps if you knew anything about the proportions of the machines used to dig the tunnel over in England. It's my understanding those were rather large pieces of machinery.
A yeah. big project, of course.
Yeah, I only know what I've read in the papers, and that was quite general. The tunnel project was dug with machines, tunnel boring machines, that were manufactured by the Robbins Company. The Robbins Company is headquartered up in Kent, Washington, and they recently merged with Atlas Copco, I believe, and are now, if I'm not mistaken, the largest tunnel boring machine manufacturer in the world. I don't know the precise diameter of those machines. I think they were on the order of, I'm guessing, about 40 to 50 feet. I'm not sure exactly. Mm-hmm. I think they used, if I remember, two machines working from opposite ends, one from the French end and one from the English end, and they met underwater, under the channel. And that raises an interesting point, in that if you were going to make a large tunnel system, and you had a tunnel boring machine that could, say, tunnel 10 miles per year. Well, if you had a fleet of these machines, say 10 or 20 or 30 of them, each working on a segment of a tunnel system over a the period of a decade, for example, each machine might conceivably bore 100 miles if they averaged 10 miles per year. And if you had 10 machines, then you could make a 1,000-mile-long tunnel system in 10 years. Now, that's speculation on my part. However, I have spoken with a gentleman who has published some articles on the open record with respect to underground excavation and tunneling, and who's also worked on black projects, or at least on projects for which he had to have a security clearance. And he told me in a general way the same thing. And he also told me during the course of the conversation, now mind you, I am not telling you that this has happened. I am just telling you that were you to do it, that this is the way that you would do it. And so that is the kind of information that you will be told off the record by people who have security clearances and who can't say much for fear of losing everything and maybe even being sent to jail for years.
That's right. Anything else, Richard?
Well, there was more regard to it as far as underground goes, and it, I guess it would be suitable for open broadcast. It was on a previous Talk America Radio sponsored show several months ago. A guy, golly, what was his name? Al Bielek, I think.
Oh, yes. Richard Sauter knows Al. I know Al.
Oh, yeah. He was talking just in terms of depth alone that they're theorized. I think he named actually a number, 131 miles that were considered deep underground, and by that he defined it as more than 1 mile underground.
Mm-hmm.
Found that rather fascinating. Why is not the general public aware of this, as far as I know anyway?
Yeah, well, I don't know the source of Al's information. I can tell you in my research that I've seen indications that the military-industrial complex was preparing to build very deep bases as far underground as 8,000 feet, which is a little over a mile and a half underground.
Wow.
And the technology does exist to do this. There were a number of very secret underground facilities made during the 1980s. During the Reagan and Bush administrations.
And we haven't been able to talk about the underground bases yet, Richard. Hang on for that one. Go ahead, Richard Sauter.
Yes. So why hasn't the public been told about these things? Well, in fact, if you're listening to this program this evening and you consider yourself part of the public, you are being told about them. However, you're not being told by an official representative of your government or a spokesperson for one of the Fortune 500 companies that are involved in constructing these things. In general, we live in a society where information, notwithstanding that we're told we're living in the information age, we're living in a society where information is very carefully controlled and the illusion of freedom is very carefully cultivated so that people feel that they have a great deal of liberty even while they are, well, I guess you could say, girdled in golden chains, and they're dazzled by the luster of the golden chains, and I think that's the answer.
Well said. We've got to head to our break now. Thank you for the call, Richard. We appreciate that. I think you summed it up really beautifully, Richard Sauter. It is an illusion here. It is sleight of hand. The average American really feels quite untethered when it comes to accessing information. We shall continue and talk about bases deep underground here at the end of the line with my guest tonight, Richard Sauter. We are back. We are talking with Richard Sauter, Ph.D., the book Underground Bases and Tunnels, What is the Government Trying to Hide? And as you open the book and look inside, You see some remarkable pictures of these huge tunnel boring machines. Most of us have never even seen one on television in a newscast, but here they are in the book, made primarily by the Robbins Company. But these are massive devices, and one can only imagine the noise of the turbines propelling them under the ground. Richard, you talked a bit about nuclear-powered patents having been issued for nuclear-powered tunnel-boring devices 25 years ago. Assuming these were built, and let's just play that for a minute here,
yes.
How would these machines move through the rock? You mentioned that they would melt the rock in front of them, and what would happen to that rock, and what would be left behind as the machine passed on through its melted portion of rock?
Well, they would vitrify the rock, which means that they would turn it to a magma-like glass, or obsidian-like glass, rather, which is what a volcano does when it heats rock. And they would plaster this this obsidian-like rock against the walls of the tunnel, and as they moved forward, that would cool into a solid, very strong glass lining. And this would then leave behind little or no debris or muck, so-called, to be disposed of. It would also provide a durable, strong structural support for the tunnel in the form of a lining that would be impermeable to water. And the machine could keep going, in theory, as long as it had fuel for its nuclear reactor.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I think if these machines are being used, that they would be hard to detect unless you had high-tech equipment.
Amazing. All right, we have to pause now just for a moment to allow some stations to identify themselves, and we'll continue with this whole amazing concept of nuclear-powered tunnel-boring machines leaving a glass tube behind them here at the end of the line. Richard, one of the most, I guess, trying parts of building a tunnel is how to get the muck, as you say, the debris out of the tunnel. But with this device, which, again, we have patent evidence, certainly is technologically feasible to the extent that the government went to the extent of patenting it, you wouldn't have muck. Most people think of solid rock. You melt it, what are you going to do with the debris? Well, rock really isn't solid at all once it's melted, is it?
No, the pressure of the machine moving through the rock and the soil as it melted it would force this glass-like substance that would be formed by the high heat, which would be on the order of, if I remember from reading the patent, 1,700 degrees or something like that, which is very, very hot. And the pressure, the hydraulic pressure of this machine would force this molten rock, which would be liquid, actually, when it was that hot, out into cracks in the rock.
I see.
And that would get rid of extra glass that would be formed by melting this rock.
And
in doing so, would actually stabilize the rock surrounding the tunnel, because the cracks that existed there would be filled with this very, very hard rock-like glass when it hardened.
One would think that black budgets being black and secret would really embrace this kind of technology with no obvious debris to have to pull out in the light of day where people would see big mounds of muck, real simple and clean.
Well, even using so-called conventional technology, people ask me, well, what about all the debris that would be produced? And I touch on this point as well in my book, in that there was a series of three documents generated by the Army Corps of Engineers back in 1961, 62, 63, 64, having to do with the construction of very large, deeply buried underground cavities, deep being on the order of 4,000 feet underground, large being spheres ranging from a few hundred feet to as much as 600 feet in diameter, which is something an underground cavity that size would virtually be able to contain a building the size of the Louisiana Superdome, for example. We're talking about a huge underground excavation.
And that's 30 years ago.
Yes, that's 30 years ago they were talking about this. I have explicit information about that projected project, whether it was carried out or not. It gives you an idea of the kind of plans that were being made by the Army Corps of Engineers 30 years ago, and that was within the state of the art in terms of underground excavation technology 30 years ago.
Wow,
now,
that's amazing.
For a 600-foot diameter spherical cavity excavated underground, along with attendant tunnels to this proposed cavity, they estimated that the spoils from that excavation could be gotten rid of and camouflaged in an 80-acre dump.
Wow, amazing. Just
yes.
Amazing. All right, we're going to pause now and welcome back our stations who have been away for news and then start talking about what may be in these underground facilities served by these tunnels as we continue here at the End of the Line. Richard Sauter, I have seen maps, as have you, sketching out potential guessed-at or possibly partially leaked routes of tunnel systems which really go back and forth across most of North America. One will not know, perhaps ever, how much of this is reality, how much of it is science fiction or wishful thinking or projection of paranoia, however you want to look at it. But there is certainly a large body of underground tunneling that has been going on for a long time. What have you heard? Now, you're a very stringent researcher, but I'm going to get into the realm of speculation just for a moment about the potential length of the tunnel system, how it might be served by transit inside of it.
Yeah, well, the stories you'll hear are that there are extensive tunnels, hundreds of miles even in the aggregate, thousands of miles of tunnels crisscrossing not only North America but other areas of the planet. And I cannot prove that. I've heard those stories. They're always second or third or fourth hand. What I can tell you, the most persistent stories have to do with an alleged secret tunnel system in the southwest United States. Now, I live in the state of Arizona. And also with an alleged tunnel complex on the east coast in the mid-Atlantic and upper south region of the country. Here's one story I heard last year, for example. My parents live in south-central Pennsylvania, just north of the Maryland line. And I was home to visit my folks over the holidays last year, and my mother happened to mention to me that one of her friends' husband worked on some tunnels in that area that he told his wife about some years back, I believe back in the 50s or 60s. And he told her that the politicians and generals would come up from Washington, D.C. in their limousines through these tunnels to underground installations there in northern Maryland and southern Pennsylvania. I can believe that. Those types of tunnels could have been made in the 40s and 50s using technology that existed and lined with cement or brick or what have you.
Sure.
And are paved, and it would have made a very nice way for the president or the secretary of state or the joint chiefs of staff to come and go. You could even have a helicopter conspicuously take off from the White House helipad while the president actually leaves in his limo underground to go to Camp David.
How about rumors of maglev trains and
high-speed
rail?
Yeah, you hear those. Maglev, of course, is the abbreviation or the shorthand term for magnetic levitation trains. And the idea there is that the trains will ride on a magnetic field, which of course takes care of the problem of friction, and ostensibly making them more efficient and able to travel faster and give a smoother ride. I can tell you that there is a gentleman named Robert Salter, S-A-L-T-E-R, who works for Litton Industries, who has written about this in a hypothetical way.
He still works for Litton?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
The article I have by him is from 1987, so that's 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But he wrote an article entitled Plane Tran Today, Prospects for the Supersonic Subway. And in this article, he gives a... There is a depiction of the continental United States, or at least the 48, lower 48 contiguous United States. And depicted in this diagram is a high-speed maglev tunnel system going from New York City down to Dallas and then over to Los Angeles with branch lines coming off of this system at various places. And he discusses using a maglev train to go coast to coast in, I think, an hour or something like that.
Wow.
With about a one-third G acceleration. So you will see that kind of article out there discussing these systems, at least in concept. I have heard, again, second and third and fourth hand that some of these alleged tube shuttles exist. One of the stories that I heard, something that was passed to me from off of the internet, is that there is a tube shuttle train that goes from the Los Angeles area, I believe, over to the China Lake Naval Weapons Center, which is in the desert in Southern California. And then from there over into Southern Nevada to the Groom Lake and Tonopah and Area 51 complex that the government, I guess, has never officially admitted exists. Now, whether or not that is true, I cannot tell you, but those are the stories that you will hear.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly think it is possible that such tunnels exist, but I have yet to see hard proof.
Mm-hmm. The issue of tunnels is one thing, underground facilities and bases quite another. Certainly they would be served by these tunnels in most cases. What kinds of size estimates do we have now for underground, deep underground bases that are not just hardened from nuclear attack, they're hardened from anything, it would seem. Do we have size? Do we talk hundreds of people potentially housed for long periods of time?
Oh,
what are we looking at now?
Thousands of people.
Thousands,
not meaning, I don't think, you know, like 100,000, but maybe 2,000 or 3,000.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the NORAD facility in Colorado. I've been told that thing goes way down, a mile, mile and a half, and that when it's buttoned up, if it goes to alert status, you may have 1,000 or more, or 2,000 people in there. And may be able to stay for a month or longer.
Mm-hmm.
I truly don't know because of the degree of secrecy surrounding these installations exactly how large they may be. I can tell you, judging from some of the plans that I have seen in the open literature that I've discovered, that some of them are really, really large. Another very large one, but now obsolete, not abandoned, mind you, but obsolete by 1996 standards, is the one of FEMA's major underground installations under Mount Weather in Northern Virginia. It's still used, but in the event of a real shooting nuclear war, for example, I don't think you would want to be there. Already back in the Carter administration, I ran across an interview with an official in Carter's Office of Emergency Management, which was the predecessor to FEMA, saying something to the effect of, you know, Mount Weather is nice, but if you're there, you know, the whole place is just going to be a nuclear gravel bed.
Right.
Because, you know, you throw a couple of 10 megaton warheads on top of any mountain, and it's gone.
Sure.
All you're left with is radioactive gravel.
Now we get to the question of uses for these things. You mentioned FEMA, which many American patriots, if you will, feel is an organization which is dedicated to a far different agenda than that which is commonly portrayed in the media. In fact, many people will tell you that 1 out of 10 or 2 out of 10 FEMA employees actually work on disaster relief plans. The rest of them are doing something far more nefarious. So the range of uses of these underground facilities can be, I guess, everything from official, what, FEMA functions to what we have rumored about massive computer underground installations.
Yeah, well, the rumors about computers underground are true. Some of these facilities do have computers in them, and sophisticated ones. The NSA, for example, at Fort Meade in Maryland, has literally entire acres of supercomputers underground.
Tracking, I am told, everything on the Internet and most every phone call or fax transmission
Yeah,
anywhere.
Well, the NSA, I believe, tracks almost probably 99% of the electronic communications on the planet. In real time, the electronic capability that the NSA has is virtually science fiction-like. God knows what they do with all of this, and it's mind-boggling, is what it is.
Personally?
There are other facilities. Uh-huh. It is known from the open literature, and I verify that. To my satisfaction, there are other facilities that have very sophisticated computer systems underground.
Well, you hear about Pine Gap in Australia being the granddaddy of all underground computer centers, allegedly, which supposedly stores about all the information and data that is storable anywhere.
Yeah, well, I don't know a lot about Pine Gap other than that it does exist.
Mm-hmm.
And if the underground installations here in North America have a veil of secrecy over them, it's even more true for Pine Gap. It's very hard to find out what goes on there, but it is true that there is a super secret installation there. I can tell you there is involvement by the NSA. I believe the CIA is involved there. NASA is involved there. The military. It's indeed a super secret, super sensitive installation.
I've heard rumors that there were 50,000 Chinese brought over laborers to work on it for years, and it's out in the middle of the outback there.
Well, I've never heard that story. You'll hear stories that'll tell you there are 50,000 Chinese in Idaho. I mean,
it's true, and Gurkha mercenaries ready to take over Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
It gets wild.
On the outskirts.
That's the point. I mean, you hear things all the time, and I want to tell you that your book does not speculate. We've been speculating here on the radio show for a bit, but the book is all nuts and bolts and extremely well documented. The phone number to get the book, Richard, or information?
Yes. You may call during business hours tomorrow, area code 815-253-6390.
And the price of the book?
I believe it's $15.95 plus shipping and handling.
All right, very good. Well, we're going to take our next break now, and we're going to recap this address information as we continue here with Richard Sauter, the author of Underground Bases and Tunnels, What is the Government Trying to Hide? Richard, we've talked a lot about the government and military defense agencies and so forth, black budgets. A lot of publicly held companies, such as Lockheed and so forth, have their own mysterious underground installations, don't they?
Yeah, well, that's true. And it's also true that companies like Lockheed Martin, recently merged with Martin Marietta,
mm-hmm.
and now they're one huge corporation.
And boy, is it.
do have their own facilities, but at the same time, it's important to remember that these large Fortune 500 companies, many of them, are not really purely what we would call in the private sector. They have so many and such large contracts with the government that really it's hard to tell where the government begins and ends and the corporate sector takes up or leaves off.
Yeah.
You know, where these underground facilities are concerned, it's also true that it's hard to tell the ownership of some of them. I'll give you an example. I spoke with a gentleman who 25 years ago came out of college with a degree in a technical field and went to work in an underground installation. He was sent there to train. All he can tell me is that there was some kind of radiation testing or nuclear research being done there. It was in Burlington, Massachusetts.
Who sent him there to train?
He thinks it was a federal government agency.
A front?
Well, but he doesn't. He's not sure what agency it was.
Okay. But just so the paychecks didn't bounce.
Yeah, right. He was a young kid, you know, and I guess he was sent to work at this place to train, and to enter the facility, you go into a building and take an elevator straight down, a deep elevator. And he said the thing that he remembers most was that some of the men that worked down there were missing body parts, like fingers were missing. One guy didn't have a nose anymore because of the radiation in his facility. And it seems absolutely mad. And here you have Burlington, Massachusetts, right there on the outskirts of Boston, and God knows what is going on underground in facilities in or near major cities all over this country. That was 25 years ago.
That would be pretty unsettling to see that. Workmen in various states of missing limbs and parts, that would be
ghoulish. It's ghoulish.
Yeah, it is.
And what kind of fool would satisfy parts of his body to the nuclear genie? I mean, it's a real glimpse into the mentality of some of the people working in at least this one underground installation. I guess you would have to say those are true believers.
I guess you would. During hour number two, we're going to talk about the UFO alien angle in all of this underground tunnel and facility business, which is profound. We'll talk about how maybe the government uses the UFO alien issue to hide and mask some of its own projects. The Dulce base, long rumored to be in the New Mexico Four Corners area, many shots allegedly taken of UFOs over that location and near it exist. Much to talk about. We've gotten the hardware out of the way here. Now we're going to get into the extraterrestrial aspect of it in hour number two with Richard Sauter, the PhD author of the brilliantly researched book Underground Bases and Tunnels, What is the Government Trying to Hide? Much more coming up in hour number three at the end of the line.